This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Kurdish officials announced Sunday that Syrian government forces are deploying along the Turkish border to help repel the Turkish military incursion against Syrian Kurds. Kurdish officials announced this on Sunday. This comes as U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said President Trump ordered all U.S. troops in northern Syria to move south, but not to leave the country. Reuters' David Doyle has more on how the region has already been impacted by military action.
The chaotic situation in northern Syria escalated at the weekend, and heading into the fray, these young Kurds. The Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, fighters graduated from their training on Saturday and are now heading to the front line. As they head towards the battle, other soldiers are moving away. The Turkish offensive was triggered after U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew some of the troops deployed to support Kurdish forces in the fight against IS. In a pre-recorded interview on Sunday, Defense Secretary Mark Esper said the U.S. is poised to evacuate all remaining troops, around 1,000 soldiers.
That's Reuters' David Doyle reporting. The U.S. impeachment probe continues to move forward as more details emerge in the complicated probe of whether U.S. President Trump withheld aid to Ukraine in hopes of exacting a political favor from the country's new president. A U.S. ambassador reportedly will testify that President Trump told him there was no quid pro quo arrangement with Ukraine. AP correspondent Mike Kempin.
European Union Ambassador Gordon Sondland is expected to tell Congress that a text message he sent to another envoy saying there was no quid pro quo in the Ukraine interactions was based on what President Trump told him. A person familiar with Sondland's testimony this Thursday before House committees says he'll also say his text was not based on any direct knowledge.
That's AP's Mike Hempen reporting. This is VOA News. Hunter Biden, the son of former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, Sunday defended his work in Ukraine and China after calls by President Trump that the two countries investigate his business dealings. Pleas that have engulfed President Trump in the impeachment inquiry. The younger Biden, whose father is one of the leading Democratic candidates seeking to face Trump in the 2020 presidential election, said in a statement issued by his lawyer that despite Mr. Trump's accusations of improprieties while he was a board member of the energy company in Ukraine for 5 years, no foreign or domestic law enforcement agency has accused him of any wrongdoing. Typhoon Hagibis killed at least 23 people and briefly paralyzed Tokyo, while 16 people remain missing as Japan tries to pick up the pieces from the deadly storm now out to sea. We get more from VOA's Zlatis Ahok.
The full extent of the damage cannot be assessed until water recedes from flooded areas. After the storm subsided on Sunday, authorities warned residents there was still the risk of rivers overflowing and inflicting more damage. In addition, floods are expected to cause deadly landslides.
The major typhoon has caused extensive damage far and wide in eastern Japan. At one point, the special warning for heavy rain was issued for as many as 13 prefectures. There has also been emergency release from various dams and flooding of various rivers. It turned out to be a record heavy rain.
Landing restrictions at Tokyo's Narita and Haneda airports were lifted on Sunday, but more than 800 flights were canceled. Some of the fast train services also were canceled. Zlatis Ahok, VOA News, Washington.
Seven people were wounded after a mortar attack by al-Shabaab militants that hit around Mogadishu Airport Sunday. The mortars landed on the heavily guarded Helene area of the airport that houses the African Union and the United Nations mission in Somalia. Witnesses told VOA Somali that six mortars were fired at the vicinity just after 1 p.m. local time. Parents of the British teen killed when his motorcycle collided with a car allegedly driven by American diplomat's wife are on their way to the U.S. hoping to seek justice. 19-year-old Harry Dunn died in August near the Crofton Royal Air Force Base, which is used by the U.S. Air Force as a communications center. Dunn's mother, Charlotte Charles, told the BBC the family hopes to meet with the suspected driver, identified by British police and Prime Minister Boris Johnson as Anne Sakoulis, wife of an American intelligence officer based at Crofton. Sakoulis claimed diplomatic immunity and returned to the United States, but later sent a letter of apology. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tunisians elect a political outsider as their next president.
Kais Saied, as you probably know, is a university professor, extremely well respected as an academic, does not necessarily belong to a very specific party. So I actually think it's a very, very positive development for Tunisia.
Professor Nezar Al-Seya is the former chair of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Striking Zimbabwe doctors plot their next move after a labor court ordered them to end their strike. The vice chair of Gambia's former military junta has returned home and will face the Truth Commission this week. And a South Sudan rebel military spokesman says progress is in ongoing cantonment process.
As far as implementation is concerned here in Juba, we have cantoned all our forces that is meant for phase one. That is around 25 cantonment sites for all the opposition.
Colonel Lamb Paul Gabriel is the deputy military spokesman for the SPLA-IO, and a new report finds an alarming increase in the number of people displaced by conflict in Burkina Faso. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tunisians have elected a political outsider in Sunday's runoff election as their next president. He's 61-year-old law professor Kais Saied. Preliminary results show that Saied secured more than 76% of the vote to beat Nabil Karoui, a media mogul. Professor Nezar Al-Seya is the former chair of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He says Tunisia, the origin of the 2011 Arab Spring, has taken another giant step towards democratization by the election of Kais Saied.
Kais Saied, as you probably know, is a university professor, extremely well respected as an academic, does not necessarily belong to a very specific party, has not indicated what positions he will actually take when it comes to helping the Nahda party form a government, which is the group that came, the strongest with 51 seats in the parliament. And at the same time, you know, his opposition or his opponent was a neoliberal candidate who was actually jailed supposedly for corruption. So I actually think it's a very, very positive development for Tunisia. And it speaks volumes of what the Tunisian people have actually managed to do.
So it speaks volume, but he's not a politician. He's an outsider.
He's definitely an outsider. And he is someone that possibly is very appropriate for Tunisia to have at this very specific historic moment of sort of trying to reignite democracy in the country.
You know, the Arab Spring began in that country. So Tunisians, is it what they wanted with this uprising?
Well, I actually think that if, in fact, there's one location in the entire Arab world in which the Arab Spring has gone through some cycles, but it seems that it has been successful, it is Tunisia. And I say that because clearly there is democracy in Tunisia. Clearly there is a free elections in Tunisia. Clearly even an outsider candidate could win over a candidate who has a media outlet, who, again, as you know, have won the largest number of seats, almost a quarter of the seats in the Tunisian parliament, and will likely be asked to form the next government.
Professor, how much cooperation do you think he can get from the so-called seasoned politicians?
At least based on the polls that I've seen, and I haven't really seen any articles yet written about his win, but from the very preliminary results, it looks like he won with a significant mandate. It looks like he won more than 70% of the vote. So very clearly, the Tunisian people are sick and tired of the politicians of the different political parties, and they wanted someone because, you know, Tunisia, at the end of the day, is a parliamentary democracy. The president has certain powers, but the prime minister is infinitely more powerful in terms of what you can do domestically. So it appears to me that, you know, this very specific combination between a president who comes possibly from the outside, who is reasonable, who does not have very strong political affiliations, having to work with parties that have to form a coalition, because even the Islamists, who I think are likely to be asked at least to form the next government, will have to work with other parties to be able to govern Tunisia.
Just talk about the future in terms of Tunisia itself, dealing with the different countries, that's the foreign affairs. Can we say now is the beginning for a stable country?
Definitely. I would have to say that, again, compared to what's happening in Algeria, where you still have a stalemate in which the situation is not fully resolved of who's going to be president and for how long and what have you, or the situation in Egypt where you have a strong man who's completely co-opted the 25th of January 2011 revolution, has become a dictator, or even the situation in Sudan where there's sort of power sharing between the military and civilian parties. Clearly, Tunisia is the shining example. And I think that in terms of the future, I can only hope that things will work very well.
Professor Al-Seya, thank you very much. We are always very happy to speak with you.
Thank you very much, James.
Professor Nizar Al-Seya is the former chair of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He was speaking with us from the Egyptian capital, Cairo. The deputy military spokesman of South Sudan's rebel SPLA-IO says both the rebels and the South Sudan government have the political will to complete the transitional arrangement for unification of both forces. Colonel Lampaul Gabriel says cantonment could be completed before the November 11 deadline if the necessary resources are made available. He says almost all senior leadership of the SPLA-IO is in Juba, except for rebel leader Riek Machar and other senior commanders.
As far as implementation is concerned here in Juba, we have cantoned all our forces that is meant for phase one. That is around 25 cantonment sites for all the opposition. Then for the government forces, that is 10 main barracks of the SSPDF, that is South Sudan People's Defense Force. And last month, we started on the fact, and up to now, the registration is still ongoing in many of these cantonment sites. We are registering the forces. So up to today, I believe we have registered more than 60,000 forces from both sides, that is from the SSPDF and also the SPIO. We have also trained instructors, that is doing instructors that will be going to train the necessary unified forces that have already been trained. So we are moving, but I know it's slow.
You are the deputy military spokesman for the SPLM-IO. You are in Juba. Is there someone from the political side who represents the SPLM-IO who is also in Juba in preparation for the formation of a transitional government?
Yes, from the political wing, we have our deputy chairperson here. We also have Madam Angelina Teng, our chairperson for security and defense, and also the wife of Dr. Madam Teng is also here in Juba. And we have the top political bureau of the SLMIO also here in Juba. So the top leadership of the SLM and SLMIO are also here in Juba. But what is now outside, I can say, is only our chairman and other senior commanders of the SLMIO, like our chief of staff. I see now it's in the field of organizing our forces to be able to report to the cantonment site and also helping the implementation of the security arrangement. And also some of our deputy chief of staff for operation and also our IGP is still outside. But it doesn't mean that they don't want to come in just because we have a team that has been selected by our commanding chief and chairman, that is the primary person, to be in Juba. That's why we are here in Juba.
So is it safe to say that the two sides, SPLM-IO and the government in Juba, you will be able to at least meet the November deadline?
One thing I can tell you is this. We have challenges in the implementation. As far as the security arrangement is concerned, we have challenges. Our challenge is lack of resources, but not lack of political will. No, we have the political will from our security point of view. The forces from both parties have the political will. What is left right now is only lack of enough resources to make sure we move forward with the completion of the implementation of the transition arrangement for the unification of our forces in time. But if we are able to have the required resources, certainly we will be able to complete our task as the mechanisms in Juba implementing the security arrangement before November 11. Now, regarding information of the government, that is purely political, and I really can't talk much about that because they have a lot of things that they also have to tackle as far as the political wing is concerned. My role here is to make sure we implement the security arrangement.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Colonel Lampaul Gabriel is the deputy military spokesman for the rebel SPLA-IO. He was speaking with us from the South Sudan capital, Juba. Today is Monday, October 14th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association says it is preparing to file papers in the Supreme Court challenging last Friday's ruling by the country's labor court, ordering the doctors to end their strike and return to work within 48 hours. But independent labor expert Davis Ndumiso Sibanda says the doctors and government should resolve their conflict through dialogue.
The doctors have two choices. The first choice is to appeal to the Supreme Court against the decision of the Labor Court, which will suspend what the Labor Court has said. That will create a bigger complication for the government because it can't do anything to the doctors until the matter is heard by the Supreme Court. Maybe as an urgent matter, that's one of the options that is there, but that will then require legal experts to look at the best possible avenue before actually taking the matter up to the Supreme Court. The other option is the doctors would have to comply, go back to work, and leave to fight another day. But in my honest view, if you look at that judgment, there are a few things that are irregular about it. The first one is the collective job action is declared illegally, and then in contradiction, the order says the doctors should not be disciplined. Automatically, that actually goes against the grain of justice. Because the moment the doctors are found on the wrong, the employer should have the leeway to actually take disciplinary action. So it's an unusual thing for somebody to be guilty and the court orders that the person should not be disciplined. So already there are windows for going to the Supreme Court. And the Labor Court, in what I've read as the judgment of the Labor Court, what has been in circulation, has not addressed the question of financial embarrassment by doctors who are saying, yes, we would like to go to work, but we don't have the money to go to work.
And what are their chances of winning?
If you look at case law from other jurisdictions, particularly from the United Kingdom, where people who have not been paid for 3 months have been found to be justified in not going to work, I would actually take a similar view to say, if the doctors can convince the court that they are financially embarrassed and they are unable to go to work with the money they have been paid, their prospects of success are very high. But the challenge that we have is that we're all not in court when the matter was argued. We are not very certain whether those issues were raised before the court. But if they were raised, the Supreme Court might rule either way, depending on the facts before it.
So now you have been talking about engagement between doctors and the government. Where's to start the negotiation?
We need to, first of all, accept that not all labor matters are capable of being resolved in court. I think that's the first thing both parties need to recognize. A matter like this, it doesn't matter how you litigate, the solution lies in dialogue, and the employer should actually be responsible and call his employees to a round table and say, yes, we've gone to court, but we appreciate that the solution lies with between the two parties. Because labor disputes, it doesn't matter who wins it. The problem at times does not go away. It's just like this particular problem. The employer has won, but he still doesn't have the doctors in the hospitals, which is a clear sign that this is a problem not capable of being resolved through litigation. All I'm saying is let government and the doctors learn from the National Employment Council and apply the same principles and say this problem will not be resolved by going to court. Let's sit down and dialogue.
Davis Ndumiso Sibanda is the Zimbabwe labor expert based in Bulawayo. He spoke with Gabe Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service. A big guest for Gambia's Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission arrived in the country over the weekend. He is Edward Singate, the former military junta vice chairman who has been accused of murdering the Gambia's former finance minister, Usman Kuro Sise. Singate landed at the Banjul International Airport in the early hours of Saturday and was immediately taken into state protective custody pending his appearance at the Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission this week. Pandero Mbaya reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Gambia's TRC says it can confirm the presence of Edward Singate in the country. Singate is the former junta vice chairman accused of committing a wide range of human rights abuses. He has been linked to the murder of Usman Kuro Sise, the former finance minister. Sise was murdered back in June of 1995. His remains were found in his Bonn official car. He was from scene of Dikteri Jame to the airport when he got murdered. Retired Army Captain Ibu Jalo was the spokesman for the former AFPRC military junta. Jalo resigned from the junta shortly after the murder of Kuro Sise. In his resignation letter, he accuses Singate and others of killing Cisse. Jallow says Singade has no choice other than facing the TRRC.
One of the reasons I would think is that he is really tired of running and he has chosen to face reality right now. So now how he is going to proceed with that from here on, that is going to be a big question.
Jallow still stands by his allegation that Singade is complicit in the murder of Koro Cisse.
I stand with what I said over the past 22 years and what I have been saying and what I wrote on my resignation letter to the APRC when I resigned, when I came to the U.S. and resigned from the APRC. So far, we have heard a partial truth of it. One of the co-murderers that killed Koro Cisse in the name of Alhaji Kanji, he went to the TRRC. We all heard his testimony.
The TRRC says Singade is likely going to appear before the commission either on Wednesday or Thursday. Jallow says it was Singade who informed him about his Singade's alleged involvement in the murder of the former finance minister.
I'm a contemporaneous witness because I was a member of the council, and if somebody commit a crime of that magnitude and they tell me, especially a person of that high rank at that time, I'll have no other reason but to believe what he told me.
Besides his alleged involvement in the murder of Koro Cisse, Singade has also been accused of taking part in the execution of about a dozen army officers back in November 1994. The officers were accused of coup plot. Jallow has called on Singade to speak the truth and allow closure to take place.
It has been too long because the more the principal actors are like stonewalling, this country will never heal and it will never bring a resolution to a lot of problems that we are going through right now. People are really angry. The passions are really high. I will strongly advise Edward Singade to go there and confess the truth.
Pa Samba Joe is a Gambian human rights activist.
I find it very, very interesting because I didn't think that he would have the courage to come. But maybe he has realized that, hey, after all, I can just go and say whatever I want to say and they will let me go.
Joe says he will not be surprised if Singade tries to incriminate his fellow former council colleagues. Retired Captain Jallow warns that any attempt on the side of Singade to distort the truth will land him into legal jeopardy. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
A new report finds an alarming increase in the number of people displaced by conflict in Burkina Faso. The report by the United Nations Refugee Agency says hundreds of thousands of civilians have had to flee insecurity. Romain Desclose is the UNHCR spokesperson.
We have reached today a milestone and a very sad and tragic one, which is 500,000 people have been forced to flee conflict and violence in Burkina Faso. And that's in the past 3 months alone, that's 267,000 have been forced to move. And if you go even earlier this year in January, it's 400,000 people have been forced to flee within the country.
In 1 year?
In less than a year.
Mm. And in addition, another 16,000 are refugees in neighboring countries.
Indeed. So we have on top of this 500,000 Burkinabe nationals fleeing within their own country, often fleeing twice or three times because of the moving violence. We have up to 16,000 people who crossed the border to seek protection and asylum in Mali and in other countries. Some of them cross into Ghana. So that's a situation that is very worrisome, especially as those who we spoke to mentioned tragic images and situation where they've been witnessing violence, they've been victims, they've been moved. They've been forced to move from a location to another because of continuing violence perpetrated against them and their community. They need to find a place where they can have access not only to protection, but to food, to water, and to have shelter. And those numbers are a staggering call for us to be able to provide them with the urgent assistance that they need.
And as you mentioned a little bit, there is a spillover. It's obviously concerning that this is happening in Burkina Faso, but it's spilled over. There's also been attacks this year in Benin. The more this increases, how much harder is it to stop the violence?
Indeed, I mean, the numbers are mind-boggling and numbering because with 500,000 people now forcibly within the country, all the regions of Burkina Faso are now hosting population that have been forced to flee. So the more time goes by, the more it will be difficult for us to be able not only to access and provide assistance to those forced to flee, but also to the communities who are hosting them. And they have shown so far a tremendous amount of generosity because most of those people forced to flee, they find refuge in families, in communities, often staying in small huts and courtyards in communities where they're being shared with just little food and the little income that those communities have, which means the support we must provide must not be alone to those forced to flee, but to the communities that are welcoming them.
That was UNHCR spokesman Romain Desclos. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Chicago, where Kenyan Bridget Kosgei broke the world record at the Chicago Marathon on Sunday to complete a sensational weekend of road running. She won the IWAF Gold Label Road Race in 2 hours, 14 minutes and 4 seconds to take 81 seconds off the longest standing marathon world record, men's or women's, in the post-war era. Kosgei, who won in Chicago last year in 2 hours, 18 minutes, 35 seconds, and improved her personal best to 2 hours, 18 minutes, 20 seconds to win in London earlier this year, set out at a blistering fast pace. After the run, Bridget Kosgei was excited at her performance.
I was not expecting to run like this, but today I make wonders to run my best time, and which I could not ever run, and I was happy again.
Lawrence Cherono, winner of this year's Boston Marathon, won a close men's contest in 2 hours, 5 minutes, 45 seconds. Ethiopia's Djigene Dibela was second in 2 hours, 5 minutes, 46 seconds. And Ashefa Megisu was third in 2 hours, 5 minutes, 48 seconds. Staying with athletics news, Eliud Kipchoge on Saturday became the first man to run the marathon under 2 hours after clocking 1 hour, 59 minutes and 40 seconds during the INEOS 159 challenge at Poretta Park in Vienna, Austria. The Kenyan Olympic champion in black shorts and white jersey completed its course in 1 hour, 59 minutes, 40 seconds, almost 2 minutes less than his world record established under conditions approved in Berlin last year.
It took another 63 years. I tried and I did not get. Now it's 65 years. I have tried. I'm the happiest man to run under 2 hours in order to inspire many people, to tell people that no human is limited. You can do it.
Sebastian Coe is IWAF president. He speaks on Eliud Kipchoge's historic run.
It's not something that would be ratified as a world record. Young people might decide that marathon running or road running is for them, or frankly just wanting to do something about their health and well-being through running, which is the most populated sport on the planet. More people do what we do than any other sport.
And in football news, Nigeria and five-time world champions Brazil played out a 1-1 draw in a friendly match at the Singapore National Stadium in Singapore on Sunday. The Super Eagles took the lead in the 35th minute through Glasgow Rangers striker Joe Aribo. Real Madrid midfielder Casemiro levered for the Brazilians 3 minutes after the restart. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And then briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Tunisians have elected a political outsider as their next president in Sunday's run of election. He is 61-year-old law professor Kai Saied. Preliminary results show that Saied secured more than 76% of the vote to beat Nabil Karoui, a media mogul. And 7 people were wounded after a mortar attack by Al-Shabaab militants hit the area around Mogadishu Airport on Sunday, Somali witnesses and officials say. And that is it for this Monday, October 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the African Export-Import Bank strives to increase the continent's share in global trade and promote growth. Afrexibank and the future on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.